Good morning, everybody. How's everybody today? There's already some really good discussions, I hope. I decided to go a different route and talk a little bit more about process and methods of the project as opposed to the sort of epidemiological data. So maybe that will answer, or maybe probably not. It'll just create more questions, as usually does. So I just want to acknowledge my co-author, Pamela McCann, who's our one of the directors of the Office of LGBT Health at our health department. And I am not evil. So the overview of the presentation, we'll talk about the project, which was locally known as Project SMART. We'll talk about our formative research, study structure, methods, recruitment, and a little bit of the survey results, just to give you a sense of who we captured in the survey. And then the sort of meat of the presentation is about the analysis of the social networks to try to get at what were sort of the social dynamics of transgenders and between transgender women, and why that may have presented a barrier for them to participate in the survey. So like I said, we're locally known as Project Chat. A lot of the background has been covered primarily by Teresa. It's a pilot study funded by the CDC and sort of administered by RTI. The goal was to recruit 100 Black or Latina trans women. We use respondent-driven sampling, which Teresa talked about, and I'll talk a lot of our social network sort of analysis stuff really delves, is really based in the respondent-driven sampling experience. So if people are not familiar with that process, I'll be happy to sort of repeat it again. We used ACASI, which is a computer-assisted interviewing. We had no Spanish survey, and we did not conduct HIV testing. So our study timeline, we were awarded the pilot grant in the fall of 2008, and then quickly had to, we were sort of under a very tight time constraint in terms of producing a final data set. So what that ended up resulting in is in a very contracted sort of formative research period. Just to give you an example, in our other NHBS projects, we spend anywhere between 6 and 9 months conducting formative research and really getting to know the population, the landscape, the people, the players, and all that. And you know, the irony of the whole thing is the population that we probably know the least, we spent the least time conducting formative research on. So we definitely do not want to repeat that next time we do this. So the formative research really consisted of developing a local CAB, a community advisory board. We recruited transgender women that we knew from other work at the health department, as well as personal contacts and friends and et cetera, and sort of got them together to talk about the project. And they really helped us develop an initial sort of seat identification, as well as sort of initial where should we have our interview sites. So I think sort of point to your question about what are places where transgender women would feel comfortable going. With, you know, would it be, you know, are office buildings better, like anonymous downtown locations as opposed to communities where they may not be familiar with the public transportation or the local sort of culture. So that was, that CAB really provided the whole of our formative research experience. So data collection began in February 2009 and then quickly ended in May 2009. So again, comparing it to other NHBS cycles, you know, we spent less than 12 weeks collecting data, as opposed to in NHBS, we spend between 16 and 20 weeks doing that. So our initial implementation, we initially recruited 5 seeds, and the 5 seeds came directly out of the CAB. They weren't necessarily members of that community advisory board, but they were directly connected to that community advisory board. And based on their advice, we opened 2 recruitment sites, one which was in downtown Chicago and the other one which was on the north side of the city, which was close to and accessible to transgender service organizations. We initially gave out 3 coupons to each participant. So this is a very important part of what I'm going to talk about later, is this coupon distribution. So the seed would get 3 coupons. That person would pass their coupons out to their transgender friends and social network members. And we paid people for their interview and also for recruitment. So I just want to, when we began the cycle, we began handing out coupons. We began interviewing our seeds and handing out coupons. And so the blue lines shows how many coupons we handed out over the first 5 weeks of the project, and the pink line represents the coupons that actually came in. So it's sort of comparing. I'm going to do a lot of comparisons to other RDS projects, particularly injection drug users and heterosexuals. And so here, what we see is that the coupon redemption line was, you know, the coupon redemption was slow. That means people weren't coming in. We had initially, you know, handed out a certain number of coupons, and a lot of coupons were sort of getting out there, but not a lot were coming back. So in other RDS studies, you know, between 40 and 50% of the coupons were coming back. At this stage of the game, we had about 15% of our coupons coming back. So because of the fact that we only had, you know, 12 weeks to recruit the entire sample, we sort of panicked at that point and sort of went back to square one. So one of the things we did is we added a couple local questions, trying to get a sense of, okay, so are people not handing them out, or are they not interested in the study, or what's going on? So we asked the women who did come in, where do you plan on giving out your coupons? And it was an open-ended question, but the vast majority of the respondents said that they were going to give them out in social service or social support kind of settings. The second most common response was parties or other social events, but it was by far the most common response was social support organizations. And then we asked, how soon will you be able to give out your coupons? And what we were actually surprised to hear that transgender women were saying that they were only able to give out their coupons one or two times per month. So compared to other social network encounters, encounters with fellow or other transgender women was not that frequent. And it sort of, to us, explained possibly why recruitment was slow. So in addition to the initial two locations, which are listed on the top, we added three locations. All three locations happen to be directly transgender service organization sites in the city. So while we initially sort of stayed away from being at the service organization, we decided, based on mostly talking to LA and people at RTI, we decided to move the project into those transgender service organizations. And then we added 10 more seats. So what do we see? So you see that the second half of the graph, you see the coupon redemption line sloping upwards, which is a good sign, meaning that coupons were the acceleration of redemption did happen. So, you know, in effect, the modification of that RDS experience did work, and it did produce ultimately 52 non-seed interviews of the 162 coupons. So we ended up about 30% of the coupons that were given out actually came back, which is low on the lower side of a good RDS sample, but it was acceptable. And then I just pilfered Teresa's slide on just showing the number of subjects that we interviewed, and the white line is Chicago, and it shows how many interviews we conducted each week. So you see from week 5 to week 12, you see the meteoric rise in interviews. So overall recruitment statistics for Chicago, we ultimately ended up interviewing 15 seeds to start these recruitment chains. We ultimately ended up distributing 164 coupons. 58 coupons came back, and most of them were eligible. So we ultimately interviewed 52 non-seed interviews. And this is just a visual display, again, thanks, Teresa, a visual display of how the recruitment chains happened in Chicago. So you see in red, you see the 15 seeds that initiated the chains. So you really only see seed number 14 on your left and seed number 2 that were able to even break out of like more than two waves of recruitment. Seed 14 was a 35-year-old woman who was a facilitator of a support group at a transgender organization. So she, you know, sort of by definition, had very good access to a very regular contact with a group of transgender women. So that was by far the most successful, or maybe you only that's the only chain that we consider successful. We can actually come back to this when I present some of the other indicators. Sample demographics, 89% black, 11% Latina. Obviously, we were restricted to those two ethnic groups. 40% of our sample was less than 21 years old. It ranged from 17 to 62. We only had one 17-year-old, so I don't want to speak on the experience on interviewing minors, but we did have one. I think the only one, right? And about a fifth of our sample was homeless at the time of the survey, and similar to LA's experience, the majority of our sample was household incomes were extremely poor. So a closer look at the social networks. So we have three indicators. One is social network size. So, you know, if you think about this coupon distribution method, it makes sense that if your social networks are big, you're going to have a better success at actually being able to pass out coupons to people. So what I did was I compared social network size from the THBS pilot to our 2007 RDS analysis of injection drug users and our 2010 analysis that's ongoing actually of heterosexuals. So the median network size for trans women compared to IDUs and heterosexuals was two to four times less than the IDU and heterosexual population. So the IDU and heterosexual populations for the most part had the same structure. It was an RDS sample. We recruited seeds through formative assessment. We distributed a similar amount of coupons to each seed. And so the structure is the same, and the interview questions to get at how many people are in your social network are the same. Essentially, it's how many of the target population that you're in do you know that you have seen in the past 30 days? So it's not only that you know them, but that you've recently seen them. I also looked at time to coupon redemption. So I give you a coupon, and you are an enthusiastic recruiter and run out the next day and give it to your friends, and then they come right back in for the interview because they're so enthusiastic about this research as well. So in a way, we sort of use this measure as a, sort of a measure of what I call like temporal density. Could this be an indicator that the social networks of transgender women are sort of looser and less connected than social networks of other populations? So transgender women took almost 13 days on average to return with a coupon, as opposed to 6.4 days among IDUs in 2007 and 3.9 days in our current heterosexual cycle. You see a pretty major difference, especially when you're talking about 12 to 16 weeks of data collection. 13 calendar days is a long time between coupons. Now, this might not be a completely accurate sort of measure of that temporal density, because how long a coupon sits in somebody's pocket is, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were searching for 13 days to give it to somebody, but it could be another measure of what we were looking at. So then we also asked, who gave you the coupon? Because it's obviously social networks are made up of people that you know, but there's different levels of people, different levels of how you know people. It could be friends, it could be acquaintances, could be associates and coworkers. So we looked at friends first, and you know, I think friends sort of form probably the core of anybody's social network. You know, you sort of you don't have to worry about trust issues or those kinds of issues when you're recruiting a friend to do a study. So you see across all three populations that friends were pretty much predominant in terms of the in terms of the people who gave you the coupon, except for the IDUs, who people you'd use drugs with were the most common people who had given somebody a coupon. But what you see among the transgender women is that the vast majority of them were recruited by a friend. And then when you look at sort of acquaintance, you see that none of the transgender women were recruited by what they considered an acquaintance. So, you know, what this is telling us is that it's possible that transgender women were not attempting to recruit outside their extremely close social context. And that could be, we don't have the breadth to go into, the depth to go into why that might be. It could be issues of trust. It could be issues of, we did hear anecdotes about people not wanting to out other people, you know, unless they knew them very well and they sort of had some sort of connection in their transgender sort of identity with somebody. It seems like people might have been hesitant to recruit somebody who they knew was transgender, but they didn't want to necessarily impose that on them. So you see that acquaintance has played a big role in the social networks of IDUs and heterosexuals in terms of the success of their recruitment efforts. So I thought that was sort of an interesting dichotomy of, you know, where the, how close the context of transgender women were compared to the sort of variety of social levels of contact for the other two populations. And then to the gender identity question. So this is our data. We asked at the end of the survey about whether you identify with certain terms to describe your gender identity. And these are not mutually exclusive, obviously. You could choose more than one. So why I sort of put this up here as maybe possibly a contributor to why recruitment was difficult is that exactly to the gentleman in the blue sweater, what he was asking about before, is what did you tell people? How did you tell them to recruit people? And that's what I was thinking of too. I said, you know, if our recruitment instructions are go out and recruit three transgender women, if there's such a vast variety of different identities out there, you know, I think we just have to be careful of how we, you know, how our instructions inform recruiters if we are going to use RDS to try to sample transgenders. So you see that the majority did identify as transgender or transsexual, but, you know, pretty substantial proportions just identified as girls, females, trans women, and the others. So there's undoubtedly a vast spectrum of gender identities and labels that people use. And so we just have, I think, have to be careful in making sure that we are telling people to recruit, you know, we're not excluding people just by labeling one particular category. So limitations, these findings are suggestive. We didn't do statistical comparisons between the populations. So I don't want to go sort of to go beyond that. Our data collection period was short, so, you know, I may be overstating the case that our recruitment wasn't necessarily successful, because if it had given it 6 months, it might have, you know, come to fruition. And all the numbers are relatively small, so, you know, I don't want, network data may not be representative of all transgender women. So in conclusion, using RDS to recruit trans women in Chicago was successful but challenging. We found that social networks of trans women may be small, potential low temporal density, meaning that these small networks, and they may not actually see each other all that often, and if they do, it might be only many times within a social service type of setting. It appears that trans women did not attempt to recruit beyond very close contacts, and trans women, I put that in quotes, may identify as a variety of gender terms, which could make referral of other trans women difficult. So some recommendations: we want to ensure time for formative research is adequate. We want to make sure that we have more initial seeds so that we can seed across a wider variety of women. We definitely encourage strong ongoing formative research. So, you know, as your sample develops, we're able to add those questions about, you know, if your recruitment slows down, you can try to figure out why. RDS field site placement is critical. Increased survey and daytime availability may be a solution to being able to connect these looser networks of transgender women. Of course, a longer data collection period. And then recruiter training scripts should definitely address the gender nomenclature. You know, they should definitely figure out a way to take into account all the different gender identities when you're trying to survey a particular population.
Do we have time for a couple of questions to Nick Pachon?
I just have one, I guess, concern about when you're speaking about the time to keep on reduction, the temporal density, and equating that with new social networks. I think we need to be very, very careful about that, considering the demographics. Because if you have 22% homeless and 54% less than $10,000 annual income, they are clearly trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this may not be their number one priority.
Sure.
And so I want to make sure that that jump, that we're being very careful.
Sure.
And perhaps, you know, LA used $10 to recruit a seed, this used $5. But when you're talking about $10,000 annual income, you know, maybe we need to consider okay. that, because the stress of the transgender community is great. And so maybe understanding that, and perhaps if we really are wanting to engage this population, is maybe recognizing that we might need to give a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think in terms of loose social networks, I'm not trying to, you know, I think definitely, you know, it's what happens in those 13 days is probably what you're just saying. It's like they're trying to pay their rent or trying to find a place to stay or, you know, trying to do whatever they need to do to survive. So it's not the top priority. But our heterosexual cycle is actually impoverished people living in like the most impoverished neighborhoods in Chicago too. So they're also having those survival issues. And in fact, from just anecdotally, we're conducting that experience now, and it's sort of the poverty and the sort of survival aspect is actually driving the sampling between that population. So it is interesting. So why would that be that way in one population and not the other? So there's a lot of different reasons.
And just very quickly, to get a job as a transgender individual.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Absolutely. So, no, it's a great point. I think it's just, you know, we have to be very vigilant with making sure that we are trying to understand everything we can about the population. It was a pre-prepared list that they answered on the screen in the interview setting. So it wasn't like somebody asking them.
Was there another?
Okay. Yes, there was. I don't remember. I don't know why the data didn't end up on here, but I'd be curious to know how many said other. What are some others? Do people have any? Like, what are... So are there any ones on that are not on here that you would expect to see or something like that?
Transvestite, a lot of the Southeast Asian, immigrant Southeast Asians, we interviewed, identified as transvestite.
Okay.